कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय ताद भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो
कृष्णाय कृष्ण भक्ताय
हियर माय ओन वॉइस,
ताद भक्ताय।
नो प्रॉब्लम। टू स्वामी पद्मनाभस विल बी टू मच इवन फॉर मी, स्पेशली फॉर मी। So welcome to all of you, Dandavan from Sweden this time. So it's very happy. I'm very happy to join all of you in this Saturday Stagosti we are having in our Tadatmya Sangha. So you're very welcome, as Bhaktarasa was mentioning also regarding the arrival to Sweden. Yesterday was arrival, was a little bit of an adventure. Like first flight canceled, almost losing second flight, almost losing third flight. And when I finally got to Sweden, my luggage didn't come. So I don't have my luggage with me. That's why, as you can see, I'm not using my usual camera that I used to have the Istagosti, which is more better quality because it's in the luggage. And that's the only cloth I have now so far. I have my winter chador with me. So I always try to have some chadar as a blessing shawl for Hari Katha. So here's summer, but I have my winter chadar. Somehow we have some chadar. So hopefully, yeah, the luggage may come some of these days. Whatever has to happen, no problem. It's just cloth. So that's a good way to also know what's the priority and what's not. So still I could continue traveling the world without that luggage, actually. So yeah, Krishna made it very clear. Yeah, as long as I have what I have in my hand luggage, including my japa mala and a few stuff, I'm here with you. So, welcome. And well, depending on where you are in which country, I thought it was today here, at least in Sweden, Guru Purnim, on the appearance day of Sri Sanatana Goswami, as well as the first month of Chaturmasya. But I've been told by Kalakanti here that is accompanying us. That is tomorrow, but I assume for some of you in the US or in India, even or other place of Europe, America, it could be is today. So I just want to share a few words, if you allow me to begin with, in honoring this sacred occasion where we are celebrating many things. I'll try not to be too elaborate on that because that deserves a lecture of its own. And we have three celebrations, which therefore deserve minimum three lectures of their own. But yeah, a few words before that, go into any questions you may have, if you allow me. So first of all, where to begin? Mostly I want to concentrate on Sri Guru Purnim, which basically is kind of the day of the Guru, basically. I mean, of course, different devotees may celebrate their own gurus in relation to their appearance day or disappearance day if they have passed. But besides that, we have like the Guru Day. Like the other day, we're celebrating the Anartha Nivritti Day on Gundicha Marjan Lila. So Guru Purnima is kind of the Guru Day, the one day in the year where we celebrate Guru. And interestingly, that's tied to Srila Vyasadeva appearance day. Actually, today's is. It's called also Vyasa Purnim, which is the day of Vyasadeva appearance. So in one sense, Vyasadeva is the archetype of the guru, like the representative of what the guru is about. And I remember talking about that in mentioning a few words in chapter, what chapter it was, chapter 11, if I'm not mistaken, of Radical Personalism, when we talk about issues and tissues between guru and disciple, and how Vyasa is the archetype of the guru. And interestingly, we've seen in the Bhagavatam that Vyasadeva not only is a guru par excellence by compiling the Shastras and so on, but for example, in terms of how a guru also shows his side as a disciple, as a student forever. Vyasadeva himself is instructing Sukadeva Goswami, his child, in the Bhagavatam, schooling him. And eventually, when Sukadeva Goswami is talking the Bhagavatam to Parikshit Maharaj, Vyasadeva is there listening. to his son and disciple explaining the Bhagavatam. So that's interesting. Again, Vyasa is the guru symbol, guru archetype or excellence. And he's not only showing perfect teaching and instruction to a disciple like he did with Sukadev Goswami, but he's shown also perfect humility and submission to the truth whenever it comes, even if it comes from his own child and disciple Sukadev Goswami. You follow my point? So that's the important point of the guru. Not only the side of as a teacher, but as a rabbi friend of mine will say, as a leader learner. Now, the guru is leading the way in terms of instruction and teaching, but guru is also leading ways in terms of learning this position. In fact, when Sukadev Goswami is speaking the Bhagavata, not only Vyasadeva is listening very eagerly, ecstatically, but even Narada Muni is listening. So Narada Muni is Vyasa's guru. So Narada Muni is listening to the disciple of his disciple exposing the Bhagavatam. He's acknowledging a particular unique current is descending right now, right here. And I'm all ears, all heart, open heart to receive that. Narada Muni is not thinking, hey, I'm Narada Muni, I should be giving the lecture myself. No, I'm the senior one here. Where's the Vyasa-san? No, this guy who is talking is the disciple of my disciple. I should be talking. He's nothing like that. That's not the culture we find in the Bhagavatam. The culture we find in the Bhagavatam is whenever, wherever, however, truth manifests, we are all disciples in front of that. We are all immediately ready to learn from that, to study that, to listen from that. No matter if it comes from my guru, from my disciple, from the disciple of my disciple, from the guru of my guru, from a tree, from a blade of grass, Mahaprabhu is saying, Trinadapi Sinichina Tarodapi Sishnona. The tree is a guru. Grass is his guru. Today in the morning, we were reading with the devotees here. We had like a 3-hour session of Harikatha and sharing. It went pretty quickly. I thought it was half an hour. And when I asked the time it was, we had to run to prepare lunch. And we were reading Krishna Karnamrita by Bilbo Mangal Thakur, a very favorite book of Mahaprabhu and also of Sadananda Swami. We are staying here now at the place of followers of Sadananda Swami, who was, as you may know, the first Western disciple of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So we were reading one verse of Krishna Karnamrita. I won't go into the details, but my point is the author of that book, Bilbo Mangala Thakur, when you go to the Mangala Charan of Krishna Karnamrita, he offers pranams to his gurus. And his main guru is a prostitute called Chintamani. So again, the point being made here is somehow or other, he was from that particular lady, and there's a whole story of that, of course, he received a certain type of epiphany. No? God's will came through that unexpected person in a very unexpected situation, as you may imagine, in connection to a prostitute. And he received the epiphany of his life. So after that, he was so transformed by that he became, again, even if it comes from a prostitute, if it's something that is inviting me to die and to be born again to a higher conception of myself, I surrender myself there. So that's the spirit of a guru. Guru is an eternal, of course, teacher, but also eternal student, an eternal friend. And since we are talking about guru and I'm here at the place of, and one of the places of Sri Sadananda Swami, I'd like to invoke a particular quote that he made in connection to his role as guru. Now, I quote that in the as the very first thing in my book on radical personalism. Let me see where it is. In the beginning of the chapter on guru and disciple, yeah, here it is, page 221. He says, Swami Sadananda says, I did not come to make disciples. I want to be a friend of those very few who desire to get a glimpse of a path and goal which is possible to reach. One should know each other very well, and such understanding may take a long time. So each other means guru and disciple. So these are the words of Swami Sadananda in terms of him as a guru. I mean, he had disciples. So he said, I did not come to make disciples. So he's having disciples, but he's not feeling they're my disciples. I'm a friend of them, these sincere souls who want to pursue the path that is possible to attain, a goal that is possible to attain. I'm willing to know that people, to learn from that people. Mm-hmm. And of course, in whatever way the guru can assist them, the disciples in the journey, that's in the context of the guru being a servant also. No, remember, first and foremost, we are celebrating Guru Purnim. Guru is a servant of the disciples' potential. I'd like to read a few sections from my forthcoming book, if you allow me also in this connection, just two paragraphs in connection to the guru being a servant of our potential, just in honoring Guru Purnim. And then we can go to whatever questions you may have. As Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur eloquently stated, the soul possesses volcanic energy, a potent force that demands responsible stewardship. Yet, mere possession of this innate power isn't enough. We require adept guidance to channel it effectively and take advantage of our potential. Within the Bhakti tradition, the guru embodies this guiding principle, serving not only as an instructor, but as a catalyst for unlocking and realizing our highest potential. In other words, a guru is a facilitator of potential. True gurus, akin to the divine, perceive disciples not through the lens of their past or present, but through the prism of their future and brightest prospect. They will do anything and everything to nurture the flourishing of that potential. One more paragraph. The guru is our own potential, appearing before us in a personified form, while assisting us in our own excavation of unbroken potential. Srimad Bhagavatam confirms this, advising us to see the guru as one's own soul. Bhaktyaikayasam guru devatatma. If our soul is imbued with limitless potential and the guru is none different from it, from our potential, then the guru embodies the soul's boundless prospect. Essentially, the guru is the humble servant of the disciple's potential. Unlike the generous glance of the guru in terms of our brightest, well, then I'm going in another direction. Let's conclude with that line, yeah. Essentially, the guru is the humble servant of the disciple's potential. My point that I think it's important to emphasize in the equation of the disciples being, of course, the humble servant of the guru, but the guru being a humble servant in his, her own way. Because again, we are all here about, it's all about service. Whether we are guru, disciple, the ultimate goal for all of us is seva. So a few reflections on Guru Purnim. I want to, on how to, in my personal feeling and approach, how I feel inclined towards how to meditate and celebrate this. Of course, not necessarily limiting it to one person, because Guru Purnim is the day of the guru. And when we say guru, remember, be careful not to define that in reductionistic ways, like just limited to one person. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, as Celestial Marshall say, we want to enter the land of gurus. That may start with one person, but we want to enter that land where everything is guru. Not only everyone, but even everything is a guru. Mm-hmm. The land itself, blade of grass, tree, everything is pointing to my highest prospect in Krishna consciousness. So we are today celebrating also that, our great fortune of entering in touch with such a principle. So Sri Guru Purnim Ki Jai. So that's it. Some invitation for any questions you may have today. Of course, I didn't say anything on Srila Sanatan Goswami and Chaturmasya, because again, that may be a dangerous extension of the topic. Maybe you have questions on that and we may address them. And if not, let's see if we have time at the end for further sharing in that direction. So first I'm seeing Karuneshwari's hand, digital hand raised. So please, you can unmute yourself.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. this question's not following on from what you've just spoken about,
Yeah,
but
no, it's okay. Perfectly fine.
okay. So this is my question from a couple of weeks ago that I'd written to you, and you were encouraging me to share it here. So I'll just remind the question, which was, we were listening recently to Richard Rohr's talk on the universal Christ, and I listened a couple of times, and there was this sense that I was listening to something really profound and wonderful, and at the same time not fully understanding all of it. And I sensed that you would have also heard that. I imagined that you would also have heard that, but probably grasped a deeper understanding. And it seemed that it was a little similar at times to maybe our understanding, like the Gaudiya understanding of maybe the universal form, maybe Brahman realization, maybe Paramatma, maybe a combination of all of those at different points. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts on what that level of realization is that he has when he's speaking about this universal Christ.
Okay, some Richard Rohr katha for a moment. Richard Rohr ki jai, why not? Guru Purnim, no? He's also, at least I will say, he's one of my gurus, why not? It's not limited to one particular tradition. So he's someone who really inspires me and teaches me and personifies many things. Well, although on a doctrinal, theological level, we may have differences, of course. Him by being a Christian, me by being a Gaudiya, but that doesn't prevent the opportunity to learn from him and from so many others. So yeah, I will include him for sure in my list of great people to remember a day like today. So yeah, I appreciate what you mentioned, Karuneshwar, in terms of that you were by listening to, I think you were referring to a lecture he gave, right? Not to the book itself. Okay, yeah, to a lecture he gave, I assume, which is the lecture one he gave in presenting the book. And you were feeling, okay, this is some, there's something profound and wonderful here. And at the same time, I don't think I'm able to fully understand it. And I appreciate those two things because that's what should be happening. When you are confronted with something profound and wonderful, probably you will have this feeling of, I don't think I'm grasping everything that is coming at this precise moment. There's a lot coming. And whatever I can just hint at or be in touch by sprinkle with, I feel it's profound and wonderful. But I get this sense of there is so much more. So, and that's the idea that we always experience something like that when we are exposing ourselves to revelation, great personalities, and ourselves remaining open to that. No, even when we don't feel that, even if I feel, oh, I heard a lecture and I understood everything, probably I should add this cautionary, as Richard Tarnas will say, epistemological modesty. I like that expression. Epistemological comes from epistemology, which means how we know what we know. And modesty means like humility, like remain humble in terms of how much you think you're understanding things. So even when you think, yeah, I understood the whole thing, probably you should add some quick warning. If I think I understood everything, that means I'm not getting it, basically. Because there's always something else that can be understood. So I saw that lecture you're referring to, but to be honest, I saw it a few years ago, although I read the book a few years ago as well. And I will reply in general to what he means, in my opinion. Although we didn't talk about that with him when we met. Maybe a good topic. But when he talks for me in terms of the universal Christ, and of course the whole book is about that, and he tries to make a difference between Christ and Jesus. He will make over and over again the point that Christ is not only Jesus' second name. But he's talking about, again, the historical figure, Jesus, the human figure, Jesus, in one sense, fully human, but human, and Christ as a more universal principle that is not limited to that particular figure, but he will say that was there present from the beginning of creation in Christian language, let's say. No, he will speak about, Christ coming at the Big Bang. He will say things like that, so to say. No, like it's not like, okay, we have to wait all these billions of years and only then Christ is coming. And before that, there was where the grace, where was the grace? And I've heard similar things from other devotees in terms of Avatar, for example. Okay, Mahaprabhu came now. So what before that? There was nothing. Of course, we have a different perspective in terms of, okay, there are unlimited universes with unlimited planet Earth. There's always a Gorlila happening somewhere. So in one way, that's always going on somewhere. And at the end of the day, sometimes we try to understand too many things with our head, no, in terms of calculating time frames. And if Krishna didn't come till the last 5,000 years would happen before, wasn't there not divine grace in the world? And again, trying to measure everything in chronological ways where God's grace is always there in so many ways, in so many places, way beyond what we can see and calculate. But going to the question, I will say that in my opinion, again, it's my opinion, and I may have to talk with Richard personally to confirm if he agrees with that, but I intuit, for as much as I know him and know his books and so far how much I kind of traced parallels between certain points in our tradition and theirs, and so far they have been pretty accurate according to his opinion, that how I will read it in our tradition is that the universal Christ is something akin to Samasti Guru Tattva, or to universal principle of Guru, while Jesus is more represented on the Vyasti Guru Tattva, or the personified agent. And the universal Christ, again, is like the agency of divine guidance, of divine revelation, what we call Samasti Guru Tattva, which is not limited to one particular person, but to begin with is God himself. No? Krishna for us is the very beginning of the Guru Parampara. It all begins with God, let's put it that way. Krishna himself says in the Gita, I am the Guru, not so many times in the Bhagavatam, sorry. And so many quotes are in the Bhagavatam referring to Krishna as Jagat Guru, Param Guru, like he's the Guru of all Gurus. So God is the Guru. God is the source of this Guru principle, of the principle of revelation, revealed knowledge, revealed guidance, enlightenment, or however you may like to call it. So in a more abstract way, and it's not abstract to say God is the Guru, of course, but without referring to one particular individual, God is the Guru again, and we are in Guru Purnim, so we're still continuing the conversation here. So Samasti Guru Tattva refers to that. This is a concept that Jiva Goswami mentions in the Bhakti Sandarbha, if I'm not mistaken, it's Bhakti Sandarbha. Samasti Guru and Vyasti Guru. So the Vyasti Guru is the individual, each particular representative, agent, of the representing the agency. So I will say that when someone like Richard Rohr or other mystical Christians, of course, who also refer to the universal Christ or cosmic Christ, sometimes different words, they are mostly speaking about this overarching presence or existence of the principle, the Christ principle, if you want to call it. They even sometimes use the term Christ consciousness, right? As something that each of us is to attain, each Christian in their language. So the universal Christ for me is that. For me, it represents the principle of guidance and revelation, which is omnipresent, all-pervading. God is the origin of that, and God is all-pervading and omnipresent. So that will be my brief explanation to you, if I understood your question correctly. Universal Christ parallels, in my opinion, Samasti Guru Tattva, the conglomerate, the universal principle of Guru, and like a figure like Jesus personifies Vyasti Guru Tattva, or the individual teacher, example, through whom, of course, God's presence is experienced, related to.
So,
if that makes sense.
Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense. And I'm wondering, as he's speaking about that, plus also maybe touching on a couple of other like understandings as well, because there's one point where he quotes a Christian lady who has this realization in a train station. I don't know if you remember hearing that bit. And she's looking at all the passengers in the train station and she's saying, oh, they're all Christ.
Yes. I think I'm remembering that. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, our reading of that will be, I wouldn't say that. Again, I was not in the train with that lady at that moment, of course, unfortunately. But I don't know if you refer, what's the type of vision she had? Because what I recall is a very overwhelming, like, revelation, epiphany she had in the train. So the nature of those revelations is very private, very personal. I cannot tell what she experienced, what she meant, but... And I'm saying that in which sense? That we as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we may be walking and there is a possibility that one may have a revelation of feeling God's presence everywhere. And that will be for me the parallel of that. Like, okay, Christ is everywhere. Krishna is everywhere. Doesn't mean that we are all Krishna in an impersonal sense for us, but actually the highest vision, the vision of the highest devotees is actually that one. Krishna is everywhere. Everything is in Krishna. Krishna is in everything. That's what we call panentheism. Panentheism. All in God. That's in the Bhagavatam. That's in the Bhagavad Gita. You can go chapter 6, verse 30. Yomam pasyati sarvatra sarvam cha mai pasyati. Krishna is describing, he who sees me in everything and who sees everything in me. That's a panentheistic version. I mean, that's panentheism defined in the Gita. No, someone who sees God in everything and who sees everything in God. No. And the Bhagavatam says the same. The Uttam Bhagavat, the most advanced devotee, has that type of vision. So as we were saying today in the morning, that's how reality looks like, ultimately. That's how reality should be looked upon. Those are the eyes with which to see actual reality. Of course, we may not be there. We cannot imitate that. We cannot force that by pressing a button, but we can have faith in those who are seeing reality in that way and align ourselves with that vision. No. Although I'm not seeing Krishna in everything and everything in Krishna, I know that's the case. I know that's what's going on. And I'm conducting my sadhana and in my life as if that's true. Although my direct experience doesn't fully confirm that yet because of my lack of vision, I know that's the truth. That's how reality operates and should be looked upon. So that's for me what resembles the vision of this Christian lady who saw, okay, they are all Christ. No? Like we could say also again, if you take Christ as the principle of revelation, the presence of the divine, of course, again, he's everywhere. That doesn't cancel the individuality of that people. No, it just speaks about the potentiality for each people to channel, to reveal, to be instrumental in allowing God's presence, because that's the potential in each of us, right? So as we say many times, and Krishna says in the Brahma Samhita, he's in every atom. So every atom, technically, scientifically speaking, every atom is imbued with the presence of the divine. So if we approach an atom with the proper attitude, that's it. You are done. You got it. Like we were talking the other day, I don't know already with whom. With some devotees who visited us in North Carolina. Quoting Sanatan Goswami, today is his appearance day. Somehow we are inviting him to be present with us. So in one of his commentaries to one verse, he comments on in his Brihad Bhagavatamrita, he's saying, if you approach a blade of grass, if you learn to see a blade of grass for what it is, you attain perfection. That's a very interesting line. And of course, it sends me to the first line of Mahaprabhu Sikshastakam, verse 3, Trinadapi Sunichena. But basically, he's saying that, no? He's saying, if you learn to relate to the grass, for what the grass actually is, implying, considering that Krishna is inside the grass, is in every atom, he's omnipresent. If you learn to address the grass properly, you attain perfection. So imagine, no? Perfection is everywhere, basically. No? That reminds me of another quote by Srila Siddhartha Maharaj that I remember I quoted in Radical Personalism. He says, perfection is everywhere. We just have to adjust our angle of vision. But perfection is everywhere, even in an atom, even in a blade of grass. Hmm?
Thank you. That's great.
I hope that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll quote Srila Siddhartha Maharaj. I just found the quote. It's just a few lines. He says, everything is full of wonder. If we analyze the atom, we will be in wonder. Only we impose limitations. But when we analyze the atomic parts of wood or stone, we will be in wonder. The infinite is everywhere. Perfection is everywhere. The trouble is that with our limited thinking, we have produced a world of limits. So that's a very encapsulated depiction of what's going on. What's actually going on and what we're missing by what's going on in our own minds, so to say, right? So those are very words that are worthy of reflection and contemplation and rumination, and go for a walk and think, look at the grass and think, what does it mean that perfection is everywhere? I'm surrounded by perfection. I'm just looking now from the window and there's so much grass here. So I'm witnessing a landscape of perfection. Even the solar panels, I'm saying. Krishna is in every atom. So again, even trying to contemplate that, even, not to capture that with our heads, but just to entertain the idea in itself, that should create its own steering and epiphany. And of course, show the limits of our head to capture such a reality. Thus point to, I need to embrace some other method, a transrational method, to actually further grasp all this. And that's what, of course, what we will say is sadhana bhakti, chanting, prayer, and so on. Something that goes beyond head, physical effort, intellectual expertise, and just surrender, opening, giving ourselves to grace. Anyhow, thanks so much, Karuneshwari. I hope that helps.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you.
Okay. So, who else? Yugal Kishore, please, you can unmute yourself.
Haribol. I'll keep it very, very simple, and I'll connect it to the question that was just asked. Okay. But I think you're on such a nice roll that we might as well keep pushing forward. So if we could make this distinction between, I think another way to say it, which you've said before in other teachers, relative and the relative form of guru, the absolute form of guru, mm-hmm. what you're calling the principle versus the individual representative. So what would service to those two things look like? Is it possible to serve the principle without serving an individual representative of that principle? And I'll give you an analogy to help, how I was understanding this. So like, I was a teacher in a classroom for many years. And if I think of my students in a classroom, that they're coming to me for something. They're coming to me to learn something. But in reality, I'm serving them by giving them, by trying to transfer, or even not just transfer what I have, but also discover some knowledge that's actually outside of both of us. So there's that relationship there between me as the facilitator. You use the word facilitator, The teacher as the facilitator and the students as really the, you know, kind of an active principle of pulling out that knowledge. So, and then if that's the case, it seems like the teacher is actually serving the students. In what sense are the students serving the teacher? What would that look like in terms of the absolute guru principle versus the relative principle?
Okay.
Is that clear enough? What does it actually mean to serve the guru?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the question, because it's important. Although we may think, like, someone quickly may say, come on, Jugal Kisho, what are you asking about? No? So many times we have said what it means to serve the guru, but many times we may get the wrong idea about what does it mean. Because ideally, again, as I also try to explain in radical personalism, both the guru and the disciple are servants of the same goal. Both are servants of God, both are servants of love, and both of them are trying to support each other in their journey of that in their own respective situations, of course, which is generally not the same. Generally, not the guru is not in the same situation as the disciple. And that's why one is a guru and one is the disciple. But also, again, at the same time, a disciple may end up channeling something to which the guru becomes a witness and a student. So it's, again, very unexpected dynamics. So my point is, when we say, okay, what does it mean to serve the guru? Service to the guru should be done not in a isolated way, not by serving my guru, understanding that figure as an isolated figure from God, from the parampara, from the ideal of love. I'm serving love by serving this person who represents love in my life. But the point is that whenever that principle of love manifests, I will serve that and not limit myself to my guru. Ultimately, the guru is love. Let's put it that way. I mean, Krishna's guru is Radha. That's what he says in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. Radhikar Prima Guru Ami Shishya Nata. That's Krishna speaking. I'm not making up anything here. You can go to Chaitanya Charitamrita and look for those his beautiful lines penned by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami. But he's, again, this is the beauty also. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami is paraphrasing Krishna. That sounds like a bold thing to do, right? You write a book and you mention what God is saying. Right? If you don't pay attention, you may read that and say, and Krishna says this, but actually that's Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami's writing. Of course, we will say Krishna is saying that through him, and that's fine. And again, that speaks about the principle of revelation and parampara and so on. So there he's saying, Krishna is saying, through Krishna Das Kaviraj, Radhikar Prema Guru, the Guru of Sri Radha, Ami Shishyanata, is my Radhikar Prema Guru, the Prema of Radha is my Guru, and I am a student. I'm a dancing student in the school of love. Now, her love makes me dance in so many ways, and I'm learning each new steps at every lesson. And Sri Radha, who is love personified, she's God's Guru. So before I said, okay, the origin of Guru Parampara is Krishna. Sorry, I correct myself. The origin of Guru Parampara is Radha. Then comes Krishna, and then so on and so forth. Of course, you don't want to make an absolute difference between Radha and Krishna. Then we start to navigate bit a bit. Today in the morning also we're talking about that. Because sometimes I say, okay, Krishna, Radha and Krishna. But in one sense, they are one. But at the same time, they're two. God is love, and Radha is love, and God is Krishna. So if God is love, God is Radha, and Radha and Krishna are one, but also there are two, bit a bit, one and different. We better get accustomed to these dynamics. My point with this is if how service to guru looks like, well, first we have to deconstruct the question and analyze what's guru, right? Because again, if we just think guru is that particular individual who whatever gave me initiation, and that's guru, and that's it. It ends there, and it begins there, and it ends there. That's not guru. That's incorrect. That's a sectarian, fragmented, partial definition of guru. You are amputating. You are isolating one guru figure from the whole guru. You are isolating the Vyasti guru from the Samasti guru. And that goes against guru. That's guru Ora Bhaknya. In fact, that's one of the Nama Parat. To actually neglect the principle of guru. Neglecting guru doesn't only mean I don't care for a guru. It means also I'm approaching or defining guru in a way that misses so many elements that that are also guru, are also to be included in my definition of guru. So if when I think serving guru only means I will cook for my Diksha guru and wash his hair cloths, which is totally beautiful and fine, and that's it. Of course, we have to begin somewhere, and in the beginning, we will be a little bit more sectarian. There is a place for healthy sectarianism. In the beginning, as I say, the baby will think, my daddy is the best daddy in the world, and there's nobody like him. And he will even dare to say that to other friends, no? Which sounds pretty fanatical, no? Because each of their friends will think the exact same thing about their own dads. So then you have your first fight as a child, basically, probably, trying to establish which is actually the best daddy in the whole planet. So there's place for thinking like that. And my Guru Dev is the only and the best, and everything comes from him and nobody. But at one point, you have to mature and grow and seek with broader lenses and realize it's not like that. Eventually, Guru is everywhere, as I say. So gradually, we have to make this journey from my guru is the best and the only one and all that stuff to there's not a place where guru is not. That should be the final landing place. There is not an atom where guru is not. Again, Srila Samaras says we have to enter into a land of gurus. Golok Vrindavan is a land of gurus. Until and unless you enter into that space, you cannot enter. You cannot actually access that realm. So we have to make this shift from seeing guru only in one place to seeing guru everywhere. Similar to the definition of Kanishta Adhikari, right? Krishna is in the altar. That's what the Shastras say. Kanishta Bhakta says God is in the altar. Curtains are closed. Oh, Krishna disappeared now. God is not here, not here any longer. It's hyper-localized, my view of God, only here. And the scriptures say, okay, it's okay. At least you are seeing God in one place. We have to begin somewhere. You see God in that corner of the room. But when you grow, Krishna will be in other altars, not only yours, not only the altar of your favorite temple or deities, other altars. Krishna will be perceived in other hearts, in every heart. And eventually, there will not be a place where Krishna is not. As I like to quote Prahlad Maharaj, when Hiranyakashipu is threatening Prahlad, I'll kill you. Where's your God now to protect you? Is he here? Is he in that pillar? And Prahlad, very in the transcendental naivete, he looks at the pillar and basically replies back to his father, where is he not? No? Is he on the pillar? And he looks everywhere and he's like, where is he not? And I cannot find a place where he's not present. That's my difficulty, Prahlad is saying. So this is similar to guru, because in one sense, again, guru is a portal to reveal Krishna's presence. So if Krishna is everywhere, then guru ultimately is everywhere as well. But in the beginning is, okay, Krishna is only in the altar, and guru is only in this particular figure. There's place for that, but there's place for growing. So how to serve the guru? To begin with, I will say, by understanding all that we are talking about here. That's the beginning of how to serve the guru, by having a proper understanding of what's a guru. So then you can even start to understand the question, what to speak about the answer to the question. But then I will say, with that proper understanding in place, the service to Sri Guru, of course, has no bounds. It's not limited to only when my guru visits my country physically and comes to my house, I can serve him. Again, that speaks about how restricted is my understanding of guru? And now my guru left his body, so I can no longer serve him. That shows how restricted is our understanding of Guru Tattva. That's why Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say things like, when the guru, the particular Vyasti individual representative, when the guru leaves his, her body, he will say that to many Prabhupada disciples. He say, when the guru leaves the body, then you will know who is a real disciple. Like implying, then we'll see who understood what it means to have a guru. Then we'll see who were only relating to the physical appearance or really have proper understanding of guru beyond the body, be as a principle, not only limited to one particular person, and even in connection to that person, something beyond the physicality, and so on and so forth. So I will say that, going to your question, the very first thing that I thought when you were making the question and it came like some sort of, huh, I never thought like that. It's like, in one sense, technically speaking, we couldn't say there, and I hope you understand that. Don't isolate my statement here and make it real to defame me, please. Okay, so get everything in context here. You say how to serve the guru, and in one sense, I felt it's not possible to serve the guru. And what do I mean by this? It's not possible to serve the guru as a separate entity from everything else that also is guru. So, and even as a guru, it's not possible for you to receive service and to think that this is to me. The very moment you think, okay, I'm the guru, my disciple is serving me, then in that precise moment, you are not acting as a guru because you are not understanding what it means to be, what it means guru. Guru is not something that I am. And they serve me, I am the guru. No, I'm a representative of an agency and I'm serving my disciple, and whatever comes back from that disciple is not for me. It's not like ending in me, no? Like how do you say when the river is flowing and it converges? No, it doesn't converge in me. I'm not the final vessel of the disciple service. Because guru is an agency, guru is ultimately Krishna, guru is ultimately Radha, and we are all servants of them. So whatever service comes to the guru as an as a human individual, that's passed internally. That's the natural dynamic. He himself say, Prabhupada will say, whatever service you give to me, I offer that to my guru, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, and he will offer it to his guru. So nobody's stealing, so to say, the service for their own. The moment they take it as such, they are not acting as guru. Transparent via medium, Prabhupada will describe the guru. So we are via medium. No? Something is passing through you. Something is passing through you from above toward your disciples, but also something is passing to you from your disciples toward above, so to say. It's both directions. No, ideally, whatever the guru is extending to the disciples is something that he's been instrumental of. And whatever he receives, he's also passing that. No? It's not sticking with something for me as a guru. You follow? The guru principle doesn't begin nor end in any of the individual representatives of Guru Tattva. That will be blasphemy, so to say. So yeah, in that sense, serving the guru implies, I will say, first having this understanding, all these understandings in place. What's guru? Mm-hmm. Because of course, Rupa Goswami says, Bishram Bena Guru Seva. One should serve the guru with trust, affection, confidence. All this is meant by the word Bishramba. But again, understanding what's guru first. No? Our problem many times is that we take for granted what certain words mean. And we already start a conversation on something without having first fleshed out the implications of something. So, no, like for example, you have to surrender to a guru, but you don't have an idea what's surrender and what's guru. So who knows what conclusion you get from that? So first, what you have to surrender to a guru? Why? What's a guru first? And what surrender? And why you have? Should it be you have? Or should it be a natural decision, the most voluntary chosen thing that I do out of attraction and wonder and moving heart, and so on and so forth. So we may need to deconstruct, so to say, the way we express ourselves in Krishna Bhakti, the way we sometimes even answer questions, present questions, and so on. So, but yeah, that's what I will say, Jugal Kishore. Even if we are serving, I don't know, if someone has to go to a practical situation, one has his, her own guru in a personified way, so it doesn't sound too abstract, and he or she goes to your place and you're listening from that person, that service to that, but that's not service to that person only. Again, you are serving what's coming through that person. Because if that person will immediately, I don't know, if your guru starts giving a lecture and then he starts to say the opposite things of what a guru is supposed to say, he starts to behave in a way that is not supposed to happen, how much you are to serve that? So my point is, how much you are serving the person separate from what's coming through the person. You follow my point? Because if we continue serving the person, let's give an example that unfortunately that has happened. Someone may be in good standing serving as a guru, and maybe through that person's mercy is coming, inspiration is coming, shelter, so many things are coming. And we honor that person because of what is coming through that person. And eventually that person starts behaving in ways that are not conducive, let's say, and the channeling somehow is stopped. If I continue serving and worshiping that person, independently of what's coming or not coming, that's a form of idolatry. No? That's not worship. Worship and idolatry are not the same thing. So it's very easy to engage in guru idolatry. Or even idolatry, maybe even I may be worshiping someone who is worthy of worship, but I'm worshiping for the wrong reasons. That's also another option. The person could be worshiped if I understand what has to be worshiped in that person. You follow? Like Prabhupada. Prabhupada was worthy of worship, of love, but some people approached him and worshiped him for the wrong reasons. And there are many reasons. And he himself will say, sometimes, to give you an example, someone will say, Prabhupada, you are Krishna himself, none different in every way, and we worship. He says, stop that nonsense. That's idolatry. That's not correct. In one sense, you can never glorify a bona fide guru enough. But at the same time, there are so many ways you can over-glorify a guru. You can glorify him for the wrong reasons. You can worship him, her, for the wrong reasons. So again, we first need to have a clear understanding of what's guru. As simple as that sounds, as complex as it is. In fact, Guru Tattva is repeatedly stated by most of our guru acharyas to be one of the most difficult topics to understand, which means one of the easiest topics to misunderstand. If something is the most difficult to understand, probably lends itself to misinterpretation very often. And it has in our Gaudiya Vaishnava history, and it continues to happen. So yeah, it's important to have a broad, deep perspective of what guru means. And again, I could continue talking. It's Guru Purnim, so for some reason the topics are coming. But I'll stop there because there are a few other questions, and even I'm seeing 12 messages in the chat. So I don't know what's going on there. So I'll go there for a minute before I see two digital hands raised, but let's see what's waiting here in the chat. Is there any questions?
Maharaj, I think Yudhishthir had a first question in the chat.
Oh, first. Here Bhakti Rasa is, okay, I didn't see that question first. Okay, let me see. Okay, here Bhakti Rasa is quoting that, I think, from Yudhishthir Prabhu. Welcome, Yudhishthir Prabhu. So nice to see you. So it's a comment or it's a question. And yet, simultaneously, there is inherently a very personal relationship possible with the primary teacher and all other souls, right? Yes, right. Of course. I don't want to, with all that I've said, I don't want to reduce the guru our relationship with Guru to any form of abstraction. Because again, there is a divine principle that expresses itself through different individuals. And of course, if properly done, that offers us the possibility of relating to each one of those mentors, teachers, in ways that are unique. And from that, from there comes all this beautiful praise that we hear of different disciples, students, about their teachers and how much love they have. And I appreciate what you mentioned, Yudhisthira Prabhu, as well, because you concluded with a primary teacher and also all other souls. Because again, if not, we can remain reductionistic. No, I love Krishna. I love my Gurudev. And that's it. What about all other souls? So that's an important point. It's a challenging point because, how to say, in one sense, it's relatively easy to love God and to love a pure devotee, to love someone with so many astonishing qualities and beauty. When we go to the category all other souls, it's like, well, I don't know if I will love all those in that list. That sounds more difficult. They're not so special. They're not the all attractive. They don't have the knowledge and purity and charisma of my Diksha, whatever. But the teachings coming from those people we love, Guru and Krishna, is you have to extend that in every possible direction. My relationship with me, Krishna says, has to be reflected in how you relate to everyone else. There's no way around it. And it's complicated, but Krishna made it that very clear in the scripture. There's this beautiful section in its third canto on Kapila Deva's instructions to Devahuti. There are a few verses, like 10 almost. I don't recall the exact number, but we refer to that in a few stagostis many times. And I never did a series on those verses, but I would like at some point. But there are very strong verses, and there are Kapila Dev, who is Bhagavan, God himself, and acting as a guru to Devahuti. So it's both God and guru. And he's saying, he's speaking about Archana mostly, but has to do from the perspective of worshiping God. So he, this verse that if you worship me, but mistreat other people, your worship is zero. It's nothing. It's useless. No? If you praise me, and if you worship my deity, or if you do this or this, but you don't extend that, you don't reflect that to other people, you're a hypocrite, basically. Very strong words and many other things. It's like throwing ashes to the fire. It's like loss of time. Like making this strong case for, basically, yeah, do not be a hypocrite. No? Be coherent. No? Let's have a coherent spiritual practice, a coherent life. If I want to love God, everything else is related to God. So everything else. So if I love him, I have to love everything else. No other way around it. And of course, that's sad in the sense that on a daily basis, we may realize how little love for God we still have by how we relate to other people, not by how we relate to God, probably. Because how we relate to God is very nice, and we do our puja and our prayer, and we chant our mantras, and everything feels nice sometimes. Not always, but even sometimes. But then we wake up from our meditation and prayer, and we start to relate to our wife and children and boss and neighbor. And where is that same love and connect? That's lost somehow. So that somehow starts to show, where's my relationship? Because I remember once one of the devotees said, okay, you, and it's a valid answer. I'm not denying that, and just want to amplify. He will say, if you want to know where's your relationship with Krishna, he will say, pay attention to your relationship with the holy name, which is none different from Krishna. So what you feel with the name, somehow is where your relationship with God is. Okay, it's a valid way to answer, but I won't say it's the only way. Another way will be, and probably this is even more challenging, do you know where's your relationship with Krishna? Well, see, where's your relationship with everyone else? Not because everyone else is Krishna literally, but because your love for him has to be reflected and extended in all the other relationships. I always like to quote this line from Dorothy Day, which is shockingly true. And she will say, I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. I will repeat it again. So you eventually fall from your seats because nobody's falling yet. So it means you didn't get it, because if you get it, you will go through the ground. I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. In other words, my love for God has to be reflected all the way down to the person I still consider my enemy. Jesus will say, love my enemy. And so many other quotes. I'm seeing that Yudhisthira probably saying, if you love me, love my dog. Thank you so much. Yeah, he used to quote that as well. If you love me, you love my dog. So again, Bhagavatam is saying, if you love God, you will love everything else, because he is everywhere. Again, if you love Krishna, and the highest devotee sees that Krishna is everywhere and everywhere is in, everything is in Krishna and Krishna is in everything, and you love Krishna, you will love everything and everywhere, because you will perceive the presence of your beloved in every atom. So how not to love everything? So again, we have no excuse to justify our not loving anything. And that's a typical question. So many times devotees ask, like, why devotees, how to say, sounds basic, but why devotees fight with one another so much? And of course, it happens everywhere. It's not only devotees. We fight with one another so much in every situation, in our human, disrupted, fragmented condition. We are not whole, unfortunately. You know, I mean, we are whole, but we are unaware of that. So we need to reclaim our actual essence and learn to be friends with one another. And that pleases Krishna so much. Establishing friendly relationship with other people is service to Krishna. Service is not just doing something, but having proper relationships. That's one of the most important offerings we can present to God. This section in the Bhagavatam is in the fourth canto, where I mentioned that the other day, where the prachetas, now these brothers are relating to each other, and they are very friendly to each other. And Bhagavan appears in the chapter 30, verse 8. And Bhagavan appears and says, I'm so pleased by the friendship you have shown to each other that ask me whatever blessing you want. So that verse shows how much Krishna is pleased by our friendly relationships with everyone. So it's a form of pleasing him. It's a favorable service, anukul seva, to Bhagavan. It's not separate. Sometimes we lose sight of that, and just our relationships end up being social functions or something utilitarian, but it's bhakti. So anyhow, thank you so much, Yudhisthira Prabhu, for your question and comment and presence. Welcome. So let's continue with Rasangi.
First of all, I had a little bit of a broadening of my understanding when you were talking about the guru being everywhere, and how much we deny ourselves wonderful experiences by making it too narrow. How we really cheat ourselves of the beautiful realizations and love and enlightenment, when we just make it a really narrow thing and we don't see that presence everywhere that we can learn from. So wonderful. Thank you. Another thing is, I loved your two podcasts last week with Jeffrey Long, I think his name was, and then Scarlett. And I just am so appreciative of your modeling how to be bridge builder, how to be a bridge builder. Even in really, you know, that's one of the challenging things, is to speak with other people of other faith, even so-called impersonalists, who we have learned to like really disrespect or not respect enough, and create bridges so that they feel understood and uplifted. So I'm so thankful that you're doing that. And my question today is, if we really believe that Krishna comes disguised as our life, which I love so much. How would things look different? How would we approach life and ups and downs? How would we show up for even the really hard things if we really believe that's Krishna and it's coming out of love?
I don't know. Who knows, no? Who knows what will happen if that will be the case? But yeah, that would be incredible.
I'd like to know.
Yeah, I'd like to know also. But also, it's not so much knowing about it, but just doing it, you know, trying to enter into that space. And that's the only way. That's the only way we will know it. And that's the invitation. Try to, yeah. This is a quote. This is not my quote, just in case to give proper credit to its author. That's Paula Darcy. I'm quite often quoted by Richard Rohr, this line, God comes to your life. God comes to you disguised as your life. So again, it's an extension of the guru talk we have been having, because if we say guru is everywhere, everywhere means everywhere. And one special manifestation of the guru principle is your life circumstances, especially those that unsettle you, especially those that trigger you, especially those that you find them challenging, or even that you will like them not to be there. Now, why? What is this teaching to me? What is the message in pain and suffering? That's a great guru. We should make a whole parampara of pain. You can make a whole timeline of your most difficult, complex chapters in your life and draw a siksha parampara there, right? The instruction coming from each one of those circumstances and how you were transformed by those, hopefully. What you became after that particular teaching and teacher. And I'm saying that because, again, many times we, not only in our tradition, in many traditions, we misinterpret spirituality just, or we reduce spirituality just to joy and happiness and ecstasy. And the message is not complete there. Because, and it's not that our tradition is teaching that. Our tradition is teaching even, I mean, if you read the most detailed descriptions of ecstasy in our tradition, and we have a lot, many of them include very painful experiences in ecstasy. So yeah. The implication is there will be pain in ecstasy, not the pain we think, because we have no idea what's that, but there will be some form of pain in ecstasy. So implying there's pain always all the way to ecstasy. So don't try to address your practice now, no? Like evading pain, and eventually you'll reach a place where you have pain forever in ecstasy. You will go crazy. You will run away from there. So actually, you have to master your coexisting with pain. So it eventually blossoms in its ultimate phase of pain in ecstasy, divine suffering. Wow. And again, I know that when I say all this, for some of us, I'm not judging you, but probably in some cases, may some triggered or some short circuiting may be there, like, what are you talking about, Maharaj? What's pain and suffering in ecstasy in eternity? I don't want that. But the only thing we are doing in that moment is just filtering my words through our own limited experience of what we think is pain, what we think is suffering. And those are the ideas who are the miserable and avoidable pain and suffering. pain and suffering, they are thanks Jugal Kishore for sharing the word passion. Like in Christianity, we'll speak about the passion of Christ, and passion means suffering. And compassion means suffering with, of course, right? So suffering with also means, I will extend the definition of compassion. It's not only suffering with others, but also we talk sometimes about self-compassion. And self-compassion doesn't mean any form of New Age self-indulgence. No, I will be self-compassionate and allow me everything. No, also self-compassion means compassion, suffer with. So suffer with you. know, accompany yourself in your suffering. Be there for your suffering. Do not escape from that. Sit with your suffering till you learn its lesson.
Wow.
Hold some space in your inner core. So suffering eventually reveals itself for what it is. And again, suffering is not something bad. Suffering, at least I talk from my experience and from what I've heard from many others as well, that moments of suffering really open the heart. Especially moments of great suffering and moments of great love are those that open the heart fully. Both. Great love, but great suffering also. And when we are not in any of those two, generally we switch back to autopilot. Spirituality, complacency, evasiveness, spiritual bypassing, status quo, boring. Living death, basically. Like the Bhagavatam will say, oh, like you are breathing, but you are death. No, there is no wonder, there's no openness, there's no transformation, there's not something alive coming. So great suffering is great teacher. So that's part. Of course, I'm not saying just only that, but that's how I understand lines like Bipodasan Tutasas Patatratatra Jagadguru, this famous prayer by Kunti Devi, Krishna, send me more problems. And you may say, oh, this lady is a masochist. You study her life stories, she already had enough problems to be asking for more. It sounds kind of dysfunctional. But the essence of the message is that, no, because she says, Apunar Bhavanar Darshanam, she says, the more these problems come, the more I see you, the more I rediscover you, the more I have your darshan. So that's Bhagavatam. Again, that's in the Bhagavatam. That's a very important section of the Bhagavatam, when Kunti Devi is teaching us how to coexist with pain and suffering and what we deem problematic. Again, problem is just our own perception of whatever is coming. What we deem problem is not problem from someone else. So like I like to say, we are not supposed to solve the problem, but the problem is coming to solve us. We are the problem to be solved, not what's coming from outside toward us. No? So we if a problem comes, it's not that, okay, how do I solve this problem? The problem is to be solved, and I am the solver of the problem. No, you are the problem, and the so-called problem is the solution that is coming to solve you. But again, we have to be in a receptive space to accept such a thing. We have to be in the mood of the student, again, of a disciple. Because if not, we will resist. We will resist, and as the saying goes, what we resist persists. No? Persists over and over again. So again, going back to Guru Purnim. When we speak about Guru Purnim, we have to speak about Sisya Purnim. Or when we speak about the Guru, we have to speak about the disciple, because there's no one without the other. One is the other. Guru is a disciple, and a good disciple is Guru. So life circumstances are such. So, and again, it's not a magical button we press. Bhaktaras already talked that magic doesn't happen by magic. So there's a whole living process and dying process to go through to become a student, to become a learner, to really find Guru in everything and to see God coming to us in our life circumstance. But at least it begins with the willingness, the honesty and the willingness to recognize those situations of life that really push me off my limits, that really create something uncomfortable thing. And instead of running from that back to stability and security, confronting the dragon in archetypal language. That shows our integrity in the journey. Because if every time we get triggered, we get bewildered, we get confused, scared, pained, we just run back to Netflix and chips, so to say. I mean, I'm not saying only that, of course, that's kind of the archetypal figure of comfort zone. It can be anything. That shows that we are not that interested in looking for God, in living a life worth living, in paying the price that we need to pay. And of course, we will fail miserably many times in that, and it will be humiliating. I will realize, oh my gosh, I'm such a mediocre guy. No, I'm so afraid of reality. I mean, that can happen. Not to pick a whip and become engaged in self-loathing, but just realizing sometimes, wow, I'm still not there. I'm still having this and this, and I need to acknowledge that, not to over-identify with that, but to acknowledge that, so I can, I'm aware of what's the work I need to do, right? And sometimes life circumstances will create that. Yeah, that's what comes now again. Besides that, my answer is I don't know. I don't know because I'm not there fully yet. So what it means to fully collaborate and participate with life and see life as God. One more thing, and then I go to Badra's question. I'm going there. One thing that came the other day, and that was very interesting connection to all this, was that, of course, we are saying, okay, your God is coming as your life, right? It's another way of saying, I like also Richard Rohr will say, I like that. He say, God is another name for reality. That's a good one. That's a genius one. Don't limit God to one person over there far away. But again, if life circumstances are God coming to you, then reality is another name for God. And in Sanskrit, you will be surprised that this word for God is the same word for reality, which is tattva. The word tattva, of course, can mean many things, sometimes translated as truth. But for example, in this famous word, our verse, arguably the most famous verse in the Bhagavatam, where the word tattva appears, Vadanti tat tattva vidas tattvam yat jnana nadbhayam brahmeti paramadmeti bhagavaneti shabdyate. There the word tattva appears twice, not only one, twice. And tattva, there it is describing reality. It says, reality is advaigyan tattva. Reality is non-dual consciousness, and it is known by the seers of truth as Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan, which are three names for God. So that's the Bhagavatam. Reality is non-dual consciousness, and that reality is known as God. So again, that's rooted in our tradition. We are not here bringing anything new, anything from somewhere disconnected. So reality is another name for God, and therefore the Bhagavatam itself is blessing this idea of God is coming through you, through your life, through reality, so to say. Anyhow, I hope that helps, Rasangi. Let's see what God wants to teach us this week through our life.
It seems that it has to do a lot with the attitude with which I embrace whatever comes my way, right?
Yeah.
How I open up or close down or get mad.
Yeah.
Or
yeah. It reminds me about this. We were talking the other day with some sharing. I think with sharing with Sherry. There is this welcoming prayer that one person wrote that is basically in that connection that is recited before when starting the day. I will recite it briefly. I have it here. It's very beautiful. It says, it's like something that one is invited to say just the very first thing one is doing before taking the cell phone, please. And it says, welcome, welcome, welcome. I welcome everything that comes to me today because I know it's for my healing. I welcome all thoughts, emotions, persons, situations, and conditions. I let go of my desire for power and control. I let go of my desire for affection, esteem, approval, and pleasure. I let go of my desire for survival and security. I let go of my desire to change any situation, condition, person, or myself. I open to the love and presence of God and God's action within. So, yeah, Thomas Merton has a similar one that also we shared the other day. And it's interesting in this prayer of welcoming, that actually it says welcome a few times, but then most of the prayer is, I let go of this and I let go of, implying, if not, you cannot welcome anything. If you are clanging on this stuff, it doesn't allow you to actually welcome life. So one thing implies the other, no? Because as you say, Rasang, yeah, it's the attitude, but what implies the attitude? No? Like when Rupa Goswami describes what's Krishna Bhakti, this, and then he says what Krishna Bhakti is not. And it implies letting go this, and the list is longer generally. Because we are mostly in that place. So anyhow, there is hope, and it's a gradual process day after day after day, and we have lots of blessings and support. So we are already on the journey, no coming back, no return.
And that's,
so that's it.
And that sin doesn't mean you're horrible and cursed. It means you missed the mark.
Yeah.
Like you said the other day, we just missed the mark this time.
We were joking the other day because in North Carolina, a couple of friends, Narayan and his partner, Rachel, came to visit us for a few days. And he likes to practice archery. So he brought, brought the aim and the arrow and the bow. So we did some archery. First time in my life, I practiced some archery. I got a taste of the Ram Lila for a minute, which is full of bows and arrows. And it was funny because, yeah, first time was, of course, first time missing the mark. And I was joking, like, I'm so sinful. I'm missing the mark. Because the word sin, for those who do not know, comes from the Greek hamartia, which is an archery term, which means missing the mark. But interestingly, we have translated that as sin, and we have given this sense to the word sin, that is something almost like you are bad ontologically as a person, something like that. You are rotten to the core. And actually, you missed the mark. So let's keep trying. So I kept trying. And at the end, finally, I could hit it. Bhakti Rasa also tried. She missed the mark one after another. And with the last arrow, I think, she got to the aim. So, and we said, until and unless we hit on the aim, there's no breakfast for anyone. So probably that was the main. Our own, biology created inspiration too. And it was funny because, at least in my case, I will miss the mark, and always I miss the mark in the same direction. So in one sense, I was hitting the same mark always, but outside of the actual aim. So that was also for me to think, okay, what does this mean beyond the archery? Because again, archery is kind of an external practice that is pointing to something internal in that connection. Anyhow, some thoughts. Thank you so much. Another day we can give a whole lecture on Dhanur Veda or the knowledge of warfare and archery and so on. So let's conclude with Badra's question. She's raising her digital hand and first time, I think, joining us in the meeting. So welcome, Badra, as well. Thank you so much. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna, everyone. So wonderful to be here with you. Yes, this is my first time, although I've been watching you not actually live for quite some time.
Yeah, and thank you for making that effort. I know you're in New Zealand, and that's quite early. That's the only thing. Yes. I will say.
It is early. I set my alarm.
Yeah.
So many wonderful questions, so many wonderful answers. And as you're speaking, so many more questions come up for me. But I'll just stick to the two questions that I've got.
Okay.
You get time to answer one of them, that will be satisfying to me. I'm wanting to understand more deeply who Srila Vyasadeva is. Mm. Like, it's said that he is the literary incarnation of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, and it's also said that is he an Ansha? Or what aspect of Krishna is he? And also, how does he relate to Sri Lord Balaram Prabhu, who is Akhanda Guru Tattva?
Mm.
So I'm just wanting to know how all these connect and what their relationship and connection is.
Okay.
That's one question. If we've got time for the other, we'll see.
Okay. Thank you. And yeah, that's a related question, of course, to today's celebrations. And somehow the whole conversation today has been revolving around Guru principle somehow or other, although it was not intended, but it happened like that. So in connection to Vyasadeva, of course, first of all, one thing is that when we say Vyasa, in a general way, Vyasa is a title and it's not referring to only one person, right? Vyasa means compiler. So it's like if I say policeman, fireman, I mean, not to compare, but that's a title, it's a role. So Vyasa means compiler. So there are many Vyasas. It's not one, but the one that we refer to in connection to the Bhagavatam and some literatures, that's what he's called, Krishna Dwaipayana Vyasa. You may have heard this complete name. So the actual name of that Vyasa is Krishna Dwaipayana. Vyasa is mostly the title. So that's one thing to clarify, just not to reduce Vyasa to one person and there's nothing else apart from that. And if we understand that in that way, which is, I think it's an important point, it's a compiler of the Shastra, so it's not no ordinary engagement. It's not like, okay, I will just sit in Samadhi and reveal Srimad Bhagavatam to the world. Sorry, it's not so easy. So in the Bhagavatam, it is described that Vyasa is a Shakti Abhish avatar of Bhagavan. Because again, it requires empowerment to engage in such a task of compiling revealed scripture, which again, it's not just, it doesn't just require academic proficiency or some academic hats that you wear. I have two PhDs, so please give me the Vyasa title. But it's more about doing that job from a place of samadhi, which means spiritual trance. The Bhagavatam describes clearly that Vyasadeva compiled the Bhagavatam in samadhi. Samadhi bhasha. Samadhi bhasha means the language of samadhi. Samadhi bhasha. So, therefore, if a book is compiled in samadhi, it's revealed in samadhi, the idea ultimately is you will fully understand it in samadhi. And the Bhagavatam invites us to that. Satyam param dimahi. Anyhow, so Vyasa is described, and of course I don't recall the exact verse number, but we can look for that later, in the Bhagavatam as a Shakti Abesh avatar. There are different types of Abesh. Narad Muni is described like, for example, Bhakti Abesh is like invested or empowered with some particular type of devotional potency. Vyasadeva is connected with Gyan also, with knowledge in terms in the context, of course, devotional knowledge as well. Shakti Abesh, which means that particular person is invested with a certain energy to do something extraordinary. In our more contemporary times, we will say that Srila Prabhupada was a Shakti Abesh avatar, which interestingly, that notion first came from Srila Bhaktiraksakthidhar Dev Goswami Maharaj. He was the first one to say, to dare to say, because that's not small statement to say that someone is a Shakti Abesh avatar. Now, some people may feel like, how you dare to call a contemporary an empowered incarnation? But of course, Srila Siddha Maharaj, like many of us, will have many reasons to make the case that Prabhupada was utterly empowered to do what he did. No, so he will say Prabhupada is a Shakti Abesh avatar. And interestingly, you may know this, but I just add the footnote. Then his successor, Srila Bhakti Sundar Govinda Maharaj, will ask Srila Siddha Maharaj, and which type of Abesh? Because as I mentioned, there's Jnana Abesh, Bhakti Abesh, Dis Abesh, these different types of investments of energy. And Srila Siddha Maharaj said, Nityananda Abesh. So Prabhupada is empowered by Sri Nityananda Prabhu for his campaign. And if you analyze Prabhupada's campaign, it's very similar to that of Nityananda Prabhu. Go into the lower section of society and from there starting a whole revolutionary campaign and so on and so forth. So so that will be in connection to Vyasadeva. Sometimes it is mentioned that Vyasadeva is, in that sense, it will be literary incarnation. I will make the point. You know, like It's a form of incarnation. Doesn't necessarily mean it's Krishna himself absolutely, but God's power is, so to say, incarnated in that particular person for literary purposes. Again, for compiling the Shastra, it requires certain empowerment. Again, it's not a mere intellectual exercise. I'll compile these books. It requires God's grace given in a very profound way. So that's how we will see Vyasa's situation. And there was something else you asked at the end, I'm missing, or I don't remember.
I was wondering how it connects up then with...
Oh, Balaram.
Balaram, and also how, and you're talking about how Srila Siddhartha Goswami Maharaj said that Srila Prabhupada is Shaktyavesh of Nityananda Prabhu, who is Lord Balaram. And that leads me to the further question of, does that not mean then that, to me, it seems to suggest that everyone who is in the capacity, or is acting in the capacity of guru, must necessarily be Shaktyavesh of Nityananda Prabhu? But that's my question.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, of course, Balaram, Baladev Prabhu is also referred to as Akanda Guru Tattva, or as the Akanda means like unbroken, right? Kanda means, refers to divisions, like Upashana Kanda, Jnana Kanda, different divisions. Akanda means without division, like uninterrupted, uncontained. Like it's another way of talking, as we talked before, Samasti Guru Tattva. Oh, the whole universal conglomerate principle of guru, unbroken. So Balaram is referred to. There's a way of speaking about Balaram as such. There's also a way, as I already mentioned, of speaking as Sri Radha as such. Sometimes the case is made by different sadhus in terms of Balaram presiding over, and I'm going a little bit on a tangent here, but it's connected, presiding over Santa Dasya Sakya and Vatsalya, and he being like the Akanda Guru Tattva in those departments, and Sri Radha being the Akanda Guru Tattva for the Madhurya department. Because again, she is the guru of Krishna. And Balaram is an expansion of Krishna, technically speaking. Paiva Prakash, as Chaitanya Charitamrita explains. So ultimately, Sri Radha is the guru, I will say. And I'm trying to prove that in one way or another. But also again, Baladev Prabhu, he's serving Krishna in so many ways. That's a point. Now he's serving Krishna as a friend, as a brother, as the Dham. He's the personification of Sandini Shakti, all the so-called inanimate objects in the Lila, which are all animated by love. Those are expansions of Balaram. So the point is he's serving in so many capacities. And because of that, he's connected with the guru, which again is very interesting because the connection between Balaram being guru is in connection to Balaram being serving in so many directions, implying the guru is first and foremost a servant in so many directions. He's serving Krishna in Vatsalya as an elder brother, in Sakya as an equal, as a friend. In Dasya, sometimes Balaram enters into the mood that he's as a servant, serves Krishna as a junior, although he's the elder brother. In Santa, by expanding as the Dham. In Madhurya Rasa, he's not involved directly. Of course, he cannot. He's Doji. He's the elder brother. So if the elder brother shows up with your younger brother with his girlfriend, that spoils the party. No? So Balaram is serving Krishna in that rasa by not being there. By knowing he's Krishna having this affair, illegal affair, quote unquote. And he knows that every midday when Krishna is with Balaram, the gopas go into the forest with the cows to do pasturing and so on. And Krishna at one point says, gives some excuse. Every day he has a new one and he's very creative and nobody notices that. Like, oh, I've heard that there's this particular person in the forest and I like to meet him, but I can't take all of you. It will be too overwhelming for him. So I will take a few of those. And Balaram says, okay, you go. I'll take care of the rest of the boys. And Balaram knows where Krishna is going. He's going to meet with Sri Radha in Radhakund and the Gopis and have romantic lila. But Krishna is giving any other excuse. I will meet an astrologer. I will meet whomever, a sage. And Balaram knows what's going on. And he serves Krishna in Madhurya Rasa by looking in the other direction to allow the whole Madhurya Lila to happen without reporting that back to Yashoda, because again, Yashoda tells Balaram, you're all the elder brother, so if Krishna makes any, does any mischief, every day we come, you report him back. And Balaram says, yes, of course, Ma, I will do. But he never reports Krishna's rendezvous with Radha, which of course is not a mischief, no, it's the highest form of morality, ultimately. There's nothing wrong with that. So anyhow, my point was that Baladev is serving Krishna in all those capacities. So he's teaching all of us how to serve Krishna. And that's basically what the guru does, if you want to put it that way. And because of that, he's connected with Akanda Guru Tattva, which of course in the Gaur Lila, he appears as Nityananda Prabhu. And Nityananda Prabhu, again, he's the guru. In Gaur Lila, he's the first one to start giving initiation during Mahaprabhu's time, before the Goswamis gave further shape to the Sampradaya, and there were all these different lineages. Nityananda Prabhu was the first one going with his Gopals, with his Dwadasa Gopals, his intimate associates, knocking door by door and just crying in ecstasy and begging people to worship Mahaprabhu, Vajagauranga, Gahagauranga, Lahagauranga, Nami, and so on, and converting thousands. So in that way, Nityananda Prabhu is tied with the idea of guru principle, and of course, personification of maximum mercy, maximum unconditional love and compassion. So it is suspected that someone who serves in the capacity of gurus, relating to people and students with that type of acceptance, unconditional, with that type of compassion and love. So that will be a connection. And what did you ask again at the end? Sorry, you added some question at the end.
It was about how the term Shaktivesh avatar, Shaktivesh of Nityananda Prabhu, can that apply to the potency of all in the capacity of guru?
Yeah, I agree. I get the point. Yeah, of course, in one sense, Chaitanya Charitamrita makes that case. It says, Kali Kalera Dharma, Krishna Nams and Kirtan, Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi Tara Pravartana. No? He says, the Yuga Dharma of Kali Yuga is Krishna Nams and Kirtan. And in order to spread Krishna Nam, Krishna Shakti Vina Nahi, you have to be endowed with Krishna's potency. So it's a way of saying you have to be empowered by God. What to speak to be a guru? So in one way, in one sense, we could make the case for saying, yes, every guru, genuine guru, bona fide guru is having some, and not even guru. No? If you are a sincere practitioner, not acting officially as an initiating guru of sorts, some type of empowerment is coming, because we are talking about empowerment. Empowerment means power. Power means potency. Potency means Shakti. Shakti means Bhakti Shakti, Swarup Shakti. So every devotee has some Bhakti Shakti, because every devotee is a Bhakta. Bhakta means there's Bhakti in you, there's Bhakti Shakti. And that's the topmost power, love. So technically speaking, whomever opens himself or herself to Bhakti, to love, is empowered on some level or another. So we could call empowered people so many people. But I will say that the term Shakti Avesha Avatar is a little bit more reserved for very like extraordinary, outstanding, extreme examples of empowerment, like very apparent, like again, like Srila Prabhupada. That doesn't mean that some other people, and this is an important point that I like to make for the sake of respect and proper relationships. Yes, Prabhupada did something absolutely otherworldly, extraordinary, hyper-empowered, but that doesn't mean that he was more advanced than all of his God brothers because they didn't do what he did. Follow my point? Because I've seen devotees many times doing that type of comparison. Nobody else did what Prabhupada did, therefore he's more advanced. So it doesn't mean that his guru didn't do what he did. That doesn't mean he's more advanced than his guru. Do you think Prabhupada will be happy with that type of praise? So my point is, people is empowered in different ways also, right? Gaur Kishore Das Babaji was empowered in his own way, and he only had one disciple. But we won't say he was less empowered than Prabhupada. No, there are different ways in which bhakti operates in everyone's life. So Shakti Avesha Avatar generally is a term referred to very outstanding achievements coming through God's empowerment. Like again, Vyasa compiling all the scriptures, Srila Prabhupada doing what he did, Narad Muni being empowered, traveling to so many places, and apart from doing some mischievous arrangements, all of that ends up in so much transformation. So I will be personally cautious in not using the term loosely, but at the same time, I will be cautious in making it clear that nonetheless, every bona fide guru, of course, has some form of empowerment, and not even only a guru, but any sincere person who is open to God's grace, God's presence, and bhakti. There is power there. There is empowerment. And we need to bring lots of empowerment in our tradition. Many times there has been lots of disempowerment. No, dishaktyavesh. No. So yeah, I think it's part of the of what our generation needs to do to re-empower every one of us in different ways, in a healthy way, and to appreciate this empowerment for what it is and try to correct, reclaim, redeem proper empowerment. And maybe some Shaktiabes stuff will come through us eventually, but first we have to learn to stop being as disempowered that many of us may have been for a long time sometimes. So anyhow, that's another conversation, but I want to just mention that. And thank you so much for your questions, Bhatra. And thank you so much to all of you for your presence, for your questions. And I think I will stop here because almost 2 hours and we have some other activities here with the local devotees. But yeah, I'll be very happy to meet you next Saturday again for our Istagosti. Thank you so much to all. Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai. Shri Shri Gaur Nityananda Gaur Gadadhar Juki Jai, Shri Shri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinath Juki Jai, Satsang Ki Jai, Shri Guru Purnim Ki Jai, Abhirbhav Mahotsav Tithi Shri Sanatan Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai, Shri Chatur Masya Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Primanand Haribo, Vancha Kalpataru Vyastra Kripa Sindhu Pyayi Vacha, Patitanam Pavanephi Vaishnavibhyanam.